Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
A cosmopolitan, by definition, is a citizen of the universe, someone who engages with issues across the globe, from politics to war to climate change. For example, you listen to WAMC, you read the newspaper, you check out your Facebook page, you may do a tweet or two, you feel like you act like that dutifully connected citizen that you are. Well, MIT's Ethan Zuckerman argues that we're living in a state of imaginary cosmopolitanism. We expose ourselves to limited kinds of information, particularly that which is already of interest to us or to those closest to us. He confronts the issue in his new book, Rewire: Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connection. Ethan Zuckerman is director of the MIT Center for Civic Media, and he is a very good friend of the show. He's been on the program for a long time, since our very beginnings of the show, and it's a thrill to have him back in Studio A. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's wonderful to be back, Joe. Thanks for having me.
It seems as though basically this gets down to we're limited, right? It's the same analogy when you look at the paper. You read what you want to read. You go to your three sections that you want to read, and then there's 70% of the paper that you never look at.
I think it's very much like the newspaper, but I actually think the internet turns that same tendency up to 11. And what I mean by that is 20 or 30 years ago, when most of us were getting our news via newspaper, via broadcast media, there are a lot of aspects of those media that make it possible to stumble on stories that you didn't expect to hear.
Right.
And now, actually, radio is sort of one of the few media where that still happens. And NPR, in fact, is a tremendous mechanism for exposing us to international news that we might not otherwise encounter.
And not to toot our own horn here, but just to interject that, and that's because it comes into our cars, it comes into our homes, whether we want it to or not.
Because you have very little choice.
Yes.
It turns out that choice is a real problem for us, because we tend to choose what's familiar. We tend to choose what we already know to be important. And so what happens when we have the internet, we either have the ability to really sort of hunt and peck our way through to find exactly what we want. Now, you mentioned the analogy of we read three sections of the newspaper, we don't read the rest of it.
Right.
When you look online, the difference between a really good newspaper like the New York Times, when we look at the front page of it, you have pieces of maybe 10 stories there. When you look at the front page of the New York Times online, you've got 300.
Yes.
And you end up having a lot more choice and a lot more ability to sort of pick and filter what you want. Think about a search engine. There is no front page. You simply tell it what you want. Think about social networks. What you want is what your friends already want. When you put those different aspects of choice into play, it suddenly makes sense that we might not be getting as much information on Syria or on China. We get what we're interested in. You're interested in horse racing. I'm interested in football. We both get a lot more of it than we used to get, but we may not be stumbling onto a lot of this very important international news. And we may end up in some ways getting more limited because we have this ability to take this very deep dive into what we already care about and what we already know about.
When we think of you and your career as being technological, a tech guy. And what I found fascinating about the book is how much of this really is rooted in psychology. I mean, it's us. It's what makes us tick. It's what we do, and ultimately what you are trying to do as an author and as an expert is basically saying, hey, why don't you broaden your horizons?
So what the book forced me to do is to really learn about two fields that I hadn't thought much about. In some ways, I started thinking about these issues more than a decade ago, when I was living and working in West Africa. And I couldn't understand why my friends in the United States understood so little about what was going on in Africa. And so
right.
The first thing I did a deep dive in was journalism and tried to understand why we pay so much attention to some stories like presidential elections and some parts of the world like Israel, and why we pay so little attention in comparison to things like climate change or agricultural policy or parts of the world like West Africa. And so as I did that deep dive, I started saying, wow, you know, this is crazy. This doesn't just exist online. This has been a problem with journalism for a long time. And so I started doing a deep dive into psychology and particularly sociology.
Yes.
And I came upon this wonderful term, homophily. And homophily is sort of one of these, you know, it sounds like a horrible, complicated word, but it's really very simple. It means that birds of a feather flock together.
Yeah.
And it's probably the single most tested and proved phenomenon in sociology. We are incredibly likely as human beings to find other people who are similar to us. If we walk into a room full of people, imagine the whole high school cafeteria, you're there on the first day, you are naturally going to figure out someone who is similar to you in terms of socioeconomic background, in terms of religious or ethnic background. And we're really incredibly good at this. And we do it unconsciously. That tendency now carries over online. And so what I've been trying to do is go back to my tech guy roots and essentially say, if homophily is limiting our worldview, if we are mostly getting information from people who are very, very much like us, if that limits us in having a global worldview, could we actually rewire the tools that we're building? Because these tools are brand new. We've only built them in the last decade or two. If we don't like how they work, it's well within our control to fix them.
The fascinating thing and what I loved about the book is that you put a lot of this on us and you put a lot of this on the media as far as changing this. I mean, I think one of the great examples is when CNN came on and we started to have a 24-hour news cycle. Those of us who are addicted to the news and want to know more about the world that we live in were just amazed and said, oh my God, we can have all of these times in these stories. So if there is a situation going on in Africa that isn't going to be covered on the nightly news in a 2.5 minute package, they have 24 hours. They can do a 12-minute story on that. But they didn't.
No,
and
they didn't.
Don't. And it's the same stuff, and it's recycled, and it's people screaming at each other, and it's Britney Spears and Miley Cyrus and all of this. And I think, oh my God, you know, we're just killing this opportunity because we have this 24-hour news cycle. So that brings up the question of homophily,
yep.
Which is much easier to read in the book than it is to say. Anyway, it's the chicken and egg thing of, so is it us who has to demand that from our media, or is it the media that has to say, okay, well, this is open up the world to us,
sure,
and say, here you go. I don't know.
Well, so I, we're going to come back to public radio on some of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, forgive me, I'm an addicted public radio fan. I'm a huge WAMC fan.
For that, we love you.
So part of what goes on in this is that media is a really unique business, news media.
Yes.
It has a business component where we have to make money. We have to try to keep the lights on and keep reporters in
right
there. But it also has a social component and it has a social mission. Part of what's gone on with CNN, and frankly, much of the rest of serious media, is that it's much, much cheaper to have talking heads. It's much cheaper to cover celebrities who really, in many ways, cover themselves than it is to go out and do that sort of expensive reporting. And so we've seen this across the board. If you look at U.S. nightly television newscasts and you look at how many of the stories are about international news, we've gone from more than 30% sort of in the early 1970s, the peak of the Vietnam War, down to about 12% now. And if you think about it, it's technologically gotten a lot easier to report internationally than it was during the Vietnam War, but we do less and less and less of it because it's very expensive and because we worry that people don't pay attention to it. See the same thing in newspapers. We've done a study at MIT. There's another group called Media Standards Trust that did a study in the UK. They saw a 45% drop in international coverage in British newspapers. So it's not just Americans. Across the board, we seem to be getting more narrow and more focused. And I think it has to do with targeting. If we want to sell you an ad, I want to know exactly what you like and exactly what you want. And I want to give you something very comfortable. Yeah. And in many ways, what I'm saying is that we need media. We need serious news to make us uncomfortable. We need it to challenge us to pay attention to things that we don't normally pay attention to. And that may make us less happy consumers, but that's an interesting challenge for the news media, because if we want to have that civic function, we need to take seriously the idea that we're giving people enough information to be part of a global economy. And we've hit a moment in time where it's just irresponsible to be too locally focused. So many of the issues that we care about, so many of the problems that we worry about today that we only pay attention to when they show up in our own backyards are global in scope, and we need a global perspective to handle them.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think you write about this beautifully in the book of how myopic we become. The one question I have, though, in reading the book you would think then, because we're still dealing with a very small sample, because if all we're talking about, because you make the point in the book about our international news coverage, but that would indicate that we care about what's going on in our communities and that we care about only what's happening in this country. But God, you know, we can't even get more than however 30% of the people to go out and vote, and in a local election you get 12%. So it's not like, even though we're focused, that it is making us better citizens, even in our own communities.
Right. It's not locality that's the focus. It's our own narrow set of interests that's the focus. In many ways, probably the group that I'm hardest on in the book is Facebook.
Right.
And I feel bad about that, because my friends at Facebook were actually very good about talking with me and sort of working with me on it. But what worries me about Facebook is that when you join Facebook, the first thing that Facebook says is, who did you go to elementary school with? Who did you go to high school with? Who did you go to college with? You know, who have you worked with? Let me reinforce those existing social networks. Facebook could handle it very differently. Facebook could say, hey, you live in Lanesboro, Massachusetts. Let me introduce you to your neighbors. Facebook actually makes that pretty challenging. Here are people in your neighborhood who are involved with politics. Do you want to get to know them? Do you want to get to know those issues? Doesn't do that as well.
Yeah.
It could also say, here are your interests. Ethan, you follow sumo very closely. Let me find you people who follow sumo across the globe and connect you with them. But it's trying to reinforce these existing offline social networks. And there's a lot of social theorists like Robert Putnam who've made the case that those geographically based social networks are not as strong as they used to be. And so Putnam in some ways blames television, he blames the internet, he sort of says if we were all going and bowling with our neighbors, we would be in better shape. And he's right. But rather than try to reinvent bowling, a fine and noble sport, let's be clear about it, we might also think about how we affect these tools. It would be great if there were something like a Facebook that tried to make it a whole lot easier to get involved with local neighborhood issues. There's a great project in Burlington called Front Porch Forum, which is just a very simple mailing list that tries to connect you with the people just in your neighborhood. And what they found from this is not only is it great for helping, you know, when your dog gets lost, helping him get delivered back home,
right,
but to be aware of what are those neighborhood issues. Even a station like AMC that takes local very, very seriously, you know, can only focus on Northern Berkshire every so often. It would be really great if we were using these tools to try to reinforce really deep local dives as well as the global, which is what my argument is really all about.
And when you think about, and one of the things about Facebook, which I found fascinating is, and you made this point here, is how simple it is. I mean, it's not like you have to come up with a new algorithm. We have this technology. It'd be very simple for them to do. I mean, I wouldn't be able to do it, but they would know how to do it. But it's knowing the audience and what, quote unquote, they want.
And this is where I'm really lucky right now that I'm at a great research university, right? So I'm surrounded by really smart grad students where I can say, imagine a Facebook that tried to get you to meet Nigerians. And my students can look at that and say, okay, let me think about how I would build that. Let me think about how I would do it. We may not be able to do it at scale, but at least we can try it with an experiment. But this is one of the things that I think people often miss. There's been such a flourishing of creativity around internet startups. We saw, you know, a wave in the late 1990s. Sure. We're seeing another wave now sort of around social media. But what's really interesting is that even within these waves, there tend to be trends. And it's very, very hard to buck those trends. And one of the big trends that's going on right now is that your friends know better than you do. And this idea that, you know, somehow if you can ask everybody on Facebook what they know, you're somehow going to get better knowledge of the world. And the answer may be you may need different friends. Not necessarily better friends, but you might need some different friends. If you want to know what's going on in China, and most of your friends are in Albany, you know, unless they're from the Chinese community in Albany, you're going to be missing out. And so you might need these tools to push in another direction and say, can we find some bridge figures? Can we find someone locally who knows China, who follows China, who understands what's going on, and who can explain it to us with some local context associated with it?
So three things before we wrap up. One is that you make the point about an immersion in other languages. Just by its very name, World Wide Web, we have an opportunity to go to other countries from our couches, to go to other cultures and to explore them and to read their newspapers and to read their news and to find out what's going on. And yet we can't even challenge ourselves to look at that their issues, much less their language, and explore that.
And language is an enormous barrier that needs to get crossed on this. We are now at a point where English is no longer the majority language of the world.
Right.
There are many more Chinese-speaking internet users than there are English-speaking internet users. The Chinese, as it turns out, are terrific at translating English language content into Chinese. We need to start figuring out how do we find and how do we support the people who make Chinese internet available in English. And we need to think about this across different languages. It's probably not Google Translate. It probably looks more like when you look at a TED Talk and you see the subtitles under this. Those are done by volunteers. Those are done by teams of volunteers who are really interested in the content, who get together to do the translation. You see this in some sub-communities. There are communities in the U.S. that translate Japanese anime into English and who get together because they're really excited about the content. I'm curious what we would need to do if we wanted to pay attention to the Chinese internet or the Arabic internet or any of these other communities that we need to pay attention to.
Obviously, as evidenced by the title of the book, it's a major theme, and I don't want to have you leave here without talking about just giving us your thought on cosmopolitanism as to how that is ultimately a thought and a label, and yet something that is also very real.
So I'm leaning on a brilliant Ghanaian-American philosopher, Kwame Appiah. And Appiah wrote a beautiful little book called Cosmopolitanism. And he basically says cosmopolitanism means recognizing that yours is not the only way to live in the world and that you might have responsibilities to other people that you don't know. It's really those two simple ideas, that there's multiple ways to live in the world and that we have responsibilities to one another. And then the question becomes, how do we deal with this in a digital age? How do we take on this challenge of paying attention to people who may view the world very differently? And how do we stand up and take responsibility at a moment where people may really need our help? And so what I'm asking is, how would we go after these tools, these technologies, these systems, so that we're listening to and paying attention to other parts of the world, so that we don't find ourselves blindsided by things like the Arab Spring, or right. We don't find ourselves sort of looking at this and saying, oh, where did SARS come from? And we may find that we're far more connected than we think. We therefore need to start having that attention and that responsibility that are tied into cosmopolitanism.
When we think about our responsibility and of becoming a global citizen and the tools that are available to us and acquainting ourselves with those tools, I remember being in college 20, 25 years ago and being told in journalism school about, you know, here's the newspaper and here's the international section, and it's on one column in the left-hand side of the A section, and if there was an ad, then it gets even reduced, you know, less than that. That's a quarter of a century ago. And we're still talking about that very issue. So I came out of this book optimistic. You give a good presentation, a good sell. So for listeners who are sort of listening to us sort of complain about things, where should we be optimistic? Why should we be optimistic that in 25 years that we will be that are global citizens?
I'm optimistic because I have the great joy that I get to hang out with some of the smartest technical people coming out of the developing world.
Yeah.
I work with people in their 20s in Kenya, in Ghana, in Nigeria. These guys want to be part of the conversation. And you know what? They're going to be.
Yeah.
And it may be a surprise when we start hearing from them, but they see these tools as a chance to level the playing field and to join the conversation. Part of what's been going on as we've been trying to figure out what's going on in Egypt is people in Egypt essentially saying, look, you actually need to listen to us. You can't just listen to CNN. You can't just read the newspapers. We're going to tell you what we think, what we feel. We want to be engaged in these conversations with you. And we now have the tools where we don't have to wait for the New York Times or CNN or whoever to pay attention. We're going to find a way to tell our own stories as well. So I'm enormously optimistic because I see brilliant people around the world using these tools. I think it's a matter of time before we figure out how to train our tools so that we're paying broader attention to the whole wide world.
The name of the book is Rewire: Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connection. Ethan is director of the MIT Center for Civic Media. Ethan Zuckerman, a great pleasure to have you with us. Always good to see you, and I thank you so much for sharing. This book is really amazing, so readable, and such wonderful data and so thoughtfully written, and I really thank you for sharing with us.
Well, thank you so much, Joe, and let me just also say thank you for everyone in the WAMC community for what you do for readers. Your show just does a wonderful job of featuring books, and for someone who's really passionate about the written word, I'm just really grateful for you giving the space on the airwaves. So
thank you very much. I appreciate that. Again, the name of the book is Rewire: Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connection. The book is published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.